Hello and welcome to another episode of The Joint Venture, two hosts covering two sectors, infrastructure and renewable energy. I'm John McNair.
And I'm Martina Camila Copullo.
And today we are bringing you a feature interview with Charles River Associates on the topic of e-mobility and its implications for the energy industry. And we'll tell you more on that a little later in the episode. But first, in a piece of personal news, this will be my last appearance on The Joint Venture. I've taken part in every episode, right back to the first launch episode we did about a year ago. And I'll be leaving with a heavy heart, of course, but listeners, you'll be left in the safe hands of Martina and whoever she co-ops into appearing alongside her. So, the end of the road for me, Martina, but I know you've got big plans coming up.
The criteria will be tough, so please send your applications and I will review them for who I pick for my next co-host. It's hard to see you going, John, but that's okay. We've been through this. I just promise I will take care of what you created a year ago with so much passion and excitement. And please be a listener.
Definitely will be. I'm subscribed on more podcast channels than you care to know about. But I was certainly carrying listening.
Going back, all the episodes that you have created with previous co-hosts and with me over the past 6-7 months, are there any favorites that you recall or any highlights that you would like to bring up?
Yeah, very much. Well, you know, like someone looks upon all their children, you can't pick favorites. But when forced to, you know, there are some that stand out. I think going right back to the beginning. Our very first interview, I think, if I remember rightly, was with Jeremy Eby from Phoenix Infrastructure Partners in the US. And we were talking about minority-owned investors and invest in minority-owned companies in general. And, you know, it was very topical, certainly at the time, but, you know, still as well with, you know, the BLM movement and lots of, you know, issues kicking off at the time in America and in Europe and around the world. And it was the febrile atmosphere of statue tumbling and all this kind of thing. And it was a great interview. And, you know, it was really good to hear Jeremy's approach and, you know, how he would, you know, propose to do things and how, you know, that it can slowly seek to sort of change the market. And you know, I think very, very important going forward as our areas infrastructure and renewable energy become more mainstream. Then there's another episode which was with Depsys and Anya Langer Jack Quinn. I just thought he's just really, really, really great person to speak to. She was so engaging and and she just had a kind of unique view on the energy systems of Europe, and she's working closely with utilities. And of course, there's some of the businesses that are most up against it, really, in terms of the energy transition. And this is something we actually touched upon later on this episode with CRA too. So a great, you know, a really interesting topic on a personal note for me, I think. And the final one I would say is our interview with Campbell Lutyens, Gordon Bynoe, just because he's such a high caliber interviewee.
Yeah.
He's a former Prime Minister of Hungary, and it shows, I think. And obviously he's very now, you know, full-time engaged with infrastructure fundraising and just knows the market inside out. But, you know, our conversation naturally ventured into all sorts of places, and it was such a great overview of not only the fundraising side of things, but also the sort of geopolitical angle, and particularly in light of the recovery and the European recovery from coronavirus, but obviously onto, you know, pushing the green agenda forward over the next sort of period, and I guess over the term of von der Leyen. Yeah, all great episodes, and I would urge, you know, if you haven't listened to them already, go back and check those out. They have my stamp of approval, but of course, all of our episodes as well. So dig in if you haven't heard any of our other earlier stuff. It's all great and all still worth listening to. But anyway, enough about me, Maritina. I haven't asked you how you are today. How are you doing?
I'm good, as you say. We're very sad to see you going. So, I've been working my head around this, yes, we besides the JV podcast, you will be missed by Inspiration Live. However, we already replaced you there with our infrastructure lead and editor and head of deal flow, Fernando Moncava. I'm sure
Yeah, what a replacement. He talking about stamps of approval, he certainly gets it from me. I tuned into his first episode this week and I thought he was excellent. As were you and Mark, of course.
Thank
So
you.
you're carrying on with Inspiration Life though, a weekly thing.
Yes, of course. It's going really great. It's actually becoming a very good product, and we see more and more people tuning in every week. And what I like about it is the freedom that to express my thoughts. It's always good to have guests and expert practitioners. However, as an analyst, I often enjoy having my own opinion and offer my own commentary on things. So I feel this freedom at Inspiration Live, and yes, we were looking forward to more engagement because we have wide participation. What I would like is someone, unmuting their microphone and jumping in and correct me, saying that I disagree with what you just said, because this is basically the meaning. The basic essence of Inspiration Live. So every Wednesday at 10 a.m., we're discussing the hot topics of each week for infrastructure and renewables. So save the date, and if you're available, feel free to join us. It's available to all.
And in a slight change from my usual approach to these podcast episodes, usually before we head into our interview, we discuss a couple of news stories. And I guess we still are talking about a news story, but I wanted to just have a singular focus on one this week, that was the publication by the International Energy Agency, or the IEA. Of its report, the net zero by 2050 roadmap for the global energy sector. Lots of stuff to unpick in this. This was pretty ambitious, and it caught a lot of attention when it was released. Do you have any initial impressions from it, Martina?
Yes, of course. I remember it came up before our previous Inspiration Live, the day before. So although I had prepared my topics, I had to put this in, but I was looking forward to discussing it in more depth. Although I don't think we will even do that today, because it's such a huge one to go through, the specific recommendations and the specific key policies. My main thought when I actually saw it, and I don't think I'm the only one, is, well, IEA is actually pivoting direction. International Energy Agency has been a crucial source of energy insights and market modeling for years. So I don't want to underestimate the importance that IEA has played in the sector and the forecasts to set ambitions in, governments, industry. However, it has always been criticized a bit to be a bit less ambitious than other counterparts. So it's not that the key recommendations policy needs to be more decisive. Net zero is feasible. Energy storage and hydrogen need to play a pivotal role, or the transition needs to be fair for all. These are basic sustainability principles that we all know for years. It was nothing new. But what was interesting is that for the very first time, I feel, it set a deadline for achievement, for the achievement of net zero. And it's interesting because IEA was created four decades ago, in around 1974 or something, according to the description that it has, to ensure the security of oil supplies.
A different world, maybe.
But it has evolved, of course. So it was interesting to see the implications for oil demand and the oil industry. So what are your first thoughts before we discuss any further?
Well, picking up on what you're saying there, you know, it's about the evolution. I think this is important, isn't it? I mean, I think it's an influential body. I mean, yeah. If it doesn't, you know, necessarily provide an exact template for countries to follow, at least, you know, it does as a body set some kind of agenda for many countries. And of course, you know, it can't be missed that this is coming in the year when obviously COP26 is coming up. Yeah. And that in itself seems like one of the more important, you know, COP events, COP summits. I mean, every few years, you know, they obviously do them every year, or last year an exception, of course, for obvious reasons. But, you know, every few years a landmark edition comes up, and this one I feel is shaping up to be like that, you know, much in the way COP21 was the last landmark. And I guess, you know, you can go back to things like Kyoto and Rio as well as previous sort of landmark summits along the way. And, you know, you talk about, you know, this was a body that was kind of set up to protect the interests of the oil and gas industry. And obviously the headline this time is, you know, it's calling for the cessation of new drilling, new oil well, new gas well drilling. And that's, you know, but will essentially bring about the end of the final expansionary phase, if you like, of oil and gas supply. And of course, you know, current wells will still operate, perhaps even to depletion under that scenario. But, you know, if this does come to pass, it will be the first time where the world will finally be saying, right, well, we've obviously recognised that fossil fuels, the end game of fossil fuels will happen in this century, but now we're actually doing it. You know, this is locked in, and we're going on that glide path down to, well, net zero. And that's quite a landmark, I think, in my view. But of course, it's not really as easy as that, is it? I mean, it brings up so many questions, not least how oil companies will react to this. I think, you know, I've seen quotes from Shell and its chief exec, Ben van Beurden, earlier on this week, or in relation to this news. And Shell is committed to no new wells no new drilling from 2025, which is not too far away. But obviously, this report from the IEA is pushing that to the present, and it doesn't seem like too many companies will be jumping at that opportunity to give up those last precious few years of new prospecting that they're hoping for. You know, the chief exec of Shell said he's concerned that just rivals will just come in and develop those wells anyway in their place. So, you know, it's his company giving up its kind of a competitive advantage there.
I couldn't agree more, John. Yes, and I commenting a bit on your first comment. Of course, it's not random that this was issued before COP26. And as you very successfully mentioned, yes, the last COP that I remember is COP21. And this was in 2015. Now, you know, we say that every year, you know, COP this year will be interesting, COP this year will be interesting. Well, I think COP26 actually will be, because there has been the push of actually upscaling targets and coming up with more robust policies globally, because even the pledges from COP21 were actually not enough. The pledges from COP21 were going to lead to a 3 degrees Celsius increase, where we're reaching for maximum 1.5 Celsius degrees. So not only we didn't see upscale, we haven't seen even implementation. But I do feel that this year, having recovered a pandemic that changed a lot of things, having, you know, some big players back in the game, I don't think now IEA is another bit to contribute to this momentum. Yes, of course, oil and gas companies would not be happy. OPEC, of course, already made the statement that this kind of news are creating volatility issues in oil and gas prices, and this could lead to a new crisis in oil and gas. Okay, the details are not very important, but this is nothing new. This is nothing new. If we think about since when we were actually discussing the transition of the oil and gas majors, it's basically from 1970. So it's 50 years. So it's nothing really new. And it's, of course, it is welcome to see all these players attempting a diversification and advancing on it. However, I was listening recently to one particular oil major. I don't have to say which one, but it was interesting because they were saying that, yes, we have put a plan, a very ambitious plan. We have the presentations ready, but we have to get to work to actually implement it. And the thing that I noticed, I remember, it was like that we have to keep a healthy oil and gas segment of the industry to finance the diversification. And to me, this there was something I didn't like about this narrative. In any case, I think this time this is changing, because it's not that the oil and gas arm will not be healthy. It is about defining what is healthy and what is not. So it's all about adapting. Of course, okay, the IEA gives a high level direction, and the details are so many until we get there. I don't think that the energy industry has the answer, but at least right now there's an extra ally in the room, and we will see how it goes. However, I do feel that, of course, it was good news, and I feel that a lot of people will need to start re-evaluating business models, because nobody's saying that oil and gas majors should give up. Of course, they're huge players full of expertise, and they are welcome to remain in the landscape. It's just that there needs to be a bit of adaptation. And in the West, in Europe, for example, generally in developed countries, it's a bit easier. My main concern would be Africa, India, China, all these emerging, extremely thirsty players and energy intensive players, and how this will be handled there. I think this was the mention. The transition needs to be just, of course, yes.
Yeah.
Let's see how we will achieve it. But we're smart people, hopefully.
It's kind of like a microcosm, isn't it? Like a just transition, for these oil companies, they need to, to make money to allow them to transition. That kind of reminds me of the just transition when you come to countries and more developing markets, in a way,
Yeah.
You touched upon business models there. I think there's there could be some degree of feeling that, the oil companies might kind of cease to be masters of their own fates as much as they are now. I mean, all the big banks and investment houses are now certainly talking the talk, and some of them are even starting to walk the walk when it comes to ESG. And from inspiration's reporting from these kind of institutions, it's the most common thing you hear nowadays, in company presentations and things. And they all say they're committed to ESG principles in their investments. And so that, if it work through, that raises the very real prospect, or at least it should do, if the words are, followed through with actions. That finance could dry up for the new drilling projects. Anyway, I mean, Goldman Sachs, for example, has already gone as far as to say it will not finance new oil and gas exploration. It did that a couple of years ago. Where a company like Goldman Sachs goes, others will follow. At the very least, a withdrawal of some big names from this arena could serve to increase cost of capital. And then you're into the realms of, does this make sense to drill for the companies? Can they afford this? Is it a good proposition? That becomes increasingly problematic in times where oil prices collapse, as we see all the time. last couple of points, and they say, I guess, that all these intentions are all well and good, but and in an ideal world, this is something I would personally like to see happen as soon as possible. That is to stop new drilling. But you also need to remember that the world, as you said, and certainly lots of thirsty emerging nations, but also around the world is addicted to oil. It's not just as a fuel for cars, and we see electrification there. It may or may not be fast enough, I don't know, to fit into this scenario. And we actually talk about that with Charles River Associates later. But also plastic, how do we wean people off plastic, or find different ways, better ways to source it or create a full circular economy, with recycling processes cleaned up as well? That's all kind of unanswered questions, and I don't even know if the IEA kind of really digs into that. But that's big questions to answer when it comes to oil. And one final thing that stood out for me, and this is a different point altogether, is just the sheer increase in volume of investment in clean energy that the IEA envisages. Basically, they're saying that there'll be a 2.5 times growth in investment, and that will go up to $5 trillion per year by 2050 into just clean energy investments, and that's it. And what I mean is, if you already feel solar, for instance, is ubiquitous, you see it everywhere. You can't drive far without passing a solar farm, for instance, on main roads. You can't, and you walk around any town, and there's tons of houses with solar panels. Well, if you already feel that is ubiquitous, you haven't seen anything yet. It will become the single biggest source of energy, according to IEA's target or roadmap, and it will multiply multiple times, if that's possible, before we reach 2050. Also, wind and other renewables will do similar. So, it's just shows you the IEA may be wrong on some of the details. They may be right. Who knows? Probably, they haven't got it entirely spot on, and some of these things may change. Like, new oil wells may be dug slightly later than they say or are asking for. But the direction is clear, isn't it? I think, and I think you have to agree with what they're seeing there. Perhaps, maybe they're even a bit conservative on that. I mean, they do have a reputation for being conservative, particularly when it comes to renewables, as you alluded to right at the top. But this is where the action's going to be for the next 30 years at least. So,
So we will have
strap
a
in.
job for another 30 years. I'm very happy about this. I'm
Hopefully.
personally happy about this.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a fun ride along the way, definitely, I think.
I think we could talk about this for much longer, but I think enough. Maybe I will do a follow-up episode, John, and maybe you could be my guest this time.
Would be happy to.
So I think it's time that we can head to our main interview. Do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Certainly. Well, as I mentioned earlier, today we're talking to Tilman Hensel-Roth, who's Vice President in the Energy Practice at the global consultancy Charles River Associates, and his colleague Meera Kotak, who is a Senior Associate there. In our conversation, we will dig into the successes and prospects for e-mobility, as well as an in-depth dive into the impact transport electrification could have for both utilities and those oil and gas companies, as we've just been talking about. With, of course, different implications for each of them. So let's not delay any longer and have a listen. Well, Till and Meera, thank you very much for joining us today on this episode of the Joint Venture Podcast. As an initial question, would perhaps both of you in turn like to introduce yourselves and just, for our listeners' benefit, give some overview of your involvement in the e-mobility space and the company's approach to that.
Thanks, John, for inviting us. My name is Till. I'm a vice president in our energy practice here in Europe. And I would say I'm probably more of a generalist, having worked my entire career across the energy value chain, and have the increasing focus of companies from all parts of backgrounds on e-mobility infrastructure, and also mainly consumer-related questions around that topic. And I'm particularly excited because at CIA, we have recently increased our focus to look at this area. Also, by running a series of webinars looking both at the energy transition, where mobility obviously plays a very important role, but also in terms of starting a collaboration with another consultancy, Hubject Consulting, which is specialized and together with us is providing, I would say, a broader view on the ecosystem and everybody who's playing in it.
I can start. My name is Mira Kotak. I'm a senior associate in our energy practice. Majority of my work is supporting retail companies and advising clients on large-scale corporate transformations. And naturally, e-mobility is becoming even more pertinent as a topic as companies are looking to evolve their traditional business models.
So since the main topic of today's conversation is about clean transportation and e-mobility, it's something that I usually like to ask our guests. Is it something positive that you experienced recently, something that excited you and gave you more, you know, positive thoughts for the outlook of the sector?
Definitely. I think quite a few things have positively surprised me in the last, short term in the last month. So following from the webinar that Till mentioned, it was really great to understand that all the major players, if you look at from investment, infrastructure, OEMs, utilities, are all aligned in the e-mobility outlook and sort of what they expect to happen in the field. I think it's great that we are beyond the pilot phase now of the transition. And it's great to hear directly from the sources and from the leaders of the fields that what they want is just continued collaboration and a bit more policy clarity going forward. So I think that for me was really great to understand, you know, that actually the players that are driving it are completely aligned and working together. I think also looking from a, you know, from a COVID perspective as well, it was a great sort of recognition of how strong the e-mobility transition is already going, that the pandemic didn't dent investment and rollout of e-mobility infrastructure. And I think this, again, just confirms that we are beyond that pilot stage and the sector isn't in its early days. So I think that was also a great sort of surprise.
Yes, I can only support that. And as an EV driver myself, I was particularly happy to see also the rollout of charging infrastructure in the UK, not only in cities, but also in rural areas during the pandemic. And I think that confirmed the perception we have that the tide has certainly turned. So the e-mobility revolution and transition to clean transport is here to stay. And it was very good to see that COVID couldn't really delay that.
Yeah, and you know, I think I would agree with those remarks about, you know, we're beyond the pilot stage, and it's kind of turned that past that inflection point, maybe where we're on the route to you know, kind of one widespread adoption of EVs. I mean, I think up until now, it's fair to say that in many markets, the adoption has been, you know, at least partly encouraged by things like grants on purchases and grants on installation of charge points and various other incentive schemes. Given, you know, what you say in terms of we're past the pilot stage, do you think there's more kind of policy initiatives needed to really push on into the mainstream stage of this area?
Absolutely. I think I think this just underlines what we expect to come out of COP26 in November this year. I think, you know, that there's a range of things that go through my mind from a sort of regulatory aspect. I think the regulators need to think about where and how they set incentives to maximise support for different demographics. And I think we can also play in, you know, the vulnerable and fuel poor just transition element that the COP26 mandate is also focusing on. So I think that's a really important point as well, to ensure that, you know, nobody's getting left behind and nobody's paying more for existing infrastructure. But broadly, I guess, from a policy perspective, I think we will see more, or we should see more market-based incentives. So, you know, a mix of financial incentives and disincentives that can really influence decision-making. And this can range from everything from you know, access restrictions, parking restrictions, congestion charges, speed limits. And I guess personally, I would like to see future policies focus more on the standardization of charging and roaming. So we can really sort of give customers the option to charge anywhere without worrying about the compatibility of their cars.
I agree. I think policy and regulation has an interesting balance to get right. On the one hand, it's about incentivizing take up of EVs and the acceptance of a new form of mobility, probably also disincentivizing the use of carbon intensive travel or even, you know, travel as such in cities and look at other modes of getting around. But in a way, you could also say regulation shouldn't get in the way, because I think personally that, and that goes in line with us saying the tide has turned, I think regulation can make the transition smoother. It can probably make it faster and speed it up. But I don't think it is necessarily needed in order to make it happen. And I think we have reached that point now, at least in Europe and in the US. And that is probably important to keep in mind when policymakers go about fine-tuning their kind of tools and instruments.
So do you actually think that EVs can actually compete without intervention, heavy intervention from policy and regulation? Is this what you mean, at least in Europe?
It is a question of time, I think, and that's a question where on the EV side, when it comes to the price competitiveness of batteries, for example, where we are not necessarily the experts. It will happen. It will probably happen depending on what report you look at in the early 2020s. So there will come a point where that certainly will be the case. So I think regulation has still a role to accelerate, to create the conditions that things can be rolled out, that new markets evolve. But I think it has reached a point where I think companies and players in the market, but also consumers, will simply make decisions of their own.
And just to add, I guess, as a final remark, I think that the role of policy and regulation is to ensure that we have a global transition. It's not a siloed, regional, state-driven, etc. And I think that's really where the benefit of forums such as COP and global regulation can really make a difference.
And I think this is a very important point, because also the road to net zero is obviously a global challenge. It's not a challenge for Europe and the US, and I think participants in our webinar also underlined that. It will be interesting to see, and you could compare that to the rollout of vaccines across the globe, right? What role governments in more developed parts of the world will play in terms of facilitating a global uptake of the technology, so that it doesn't only become essentially a European or a rich country's transition.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point in terms of the international scene. I think there's, we've seen, if we break it down into kind of an international level, though, I mean, we've seen places kind of run away with and have great successful initiatives, places like Norway spring to mind, the Netherlands, and various others. In amongst those countries, I mean, is there specific things that one can be learning from another? I mean, maybe, then this will be something that will be kind of got across during events like COP26 and a harmonizing of those approaches potentially. What do we see there?
So, we would immediately agree that learning from each other and comparing experiences is very valuable, right? So, absolutely. At the same time, I think you simply can't copy and paste models from one country to others. Norway or the Netherlands, obviously, demographically and from their footprints, very different countries from countries like the UK, France, Spain, the US. So I think every country, or even within the US, every state probably has different kind of requirements and demographies to deal with. And I think it should be to a certain level, regulation has to be localized when it comes to the consumer experience and making sure consumers can travel between borders, because mobility isn't tied to cities or isn't tied to states or isn't tied to European countries. That's why I think regulation can be standardized and has to be standardized in order to facilitate the uptake.
What are your experiences from the US market? Because we've mentioned the country quite some time, so I had to ask. And from a personal perspective, I wonder, with such low oil and gas prices in the country, how competitive EVs would be, and what is the necessary regulation to make this happen?
So I think an increase in federal policy, which would mitigate any state disparity in creating a suitable environment and ensure that the mandate does come sort of top down, would facilitate that transition, similar to what we're seeing in the EU. But I mean, on the flip side, utilities are sort of taking it into their own hands there. So there's a West Coast consortium of around 11 utilities that are just building their own charging corridors and sort of pushing the transition, regardless of what that top-down federal regulation is stating. So I think these sorts of initiatives by major players with the capital and the sort of understanding of their customer needs is one way to shift that, but definitely also more of a standardized push. And this is a key theme that was resonating in the seminar that we held. But I guess overall, it's to Till's point earlier, any, cross-continent, cross-pollination of ideas and sharing of expertise is what everyone needs to get there.
And would you say that, is there anything, you know, any ideas that could come the other way? I mean, we spoke maybe about following a European template, but, you know, as Till says, there's very different conditions and experiences in lots of different markets. I mean, is there initiatives in the US that look neat and could be transported nicely over to Europe?
So certainly, and it doesn't have to be necessarily regulation. I think we are seeing already, in terms of technology, OEM innovation, a lot of ideas, a lot of innovation shaping markets and expectations of consumers what good looks like in terms of user experiences. And I wouldn't be surprised if the US will speed up in generating this innovation that might set standards globally. So I think it's not only the likes of Tesla, it's tech companies, it's smaller players, startups. It is a rich environment for driving innovation. And I think we will probably see a lot of that spilling over to other countries and regions, including Europe.
And just to add, I think we can also look at lessons learned beyond regions, but just from other industries. So I think telecommunications and roaming services beyond borders, we can all use our phone in different countries, often without charges, for example, within the EU. And I think there's a lot of tried and tested comparable sort of processes that we should be also leveraging. And it'd be interesting if the COP summit does sort of bring in that shared learning as well.
A very interesting question is to what extent mobility, but not only mobility and the uptake of e-mobility, the general move of consumers to become prosumers when it comes to the energy space, will impact what kind of assets are regulated and what kind of assets are non-regulated. If you look globally, a lot of the wires in the ground that are crucial to provide electrons to chargers, right, and into people's cars, those are currently regulated asset bases, but they're increasingly being used for mixed cases, both in B2C and B2B environments, where people have potentially in the future vehicle-to-grid applications, where they produce their own energy through PVs, panels on the roof. So you might see some rethinking of regulatory frameworks, which in turn might then open up interesting opportunities for businesses, including investors. So that's probably a space to watch.
That is a very interesting point. I would like to focus on utilities and incumbents, because as you mentioned, Till and Mira, utilities are aiming to be at the forefront of bridging the gap between EV deployment and charging infrastructure. As you mentioned, they have been having access to grid infrastructure, long-standing experience in energy, and multi-dimensional relationships, basically, with generation and with the consumer, that is increasingly turning into prosumer. So I find the role extremely pivotal. And of course, they also have access to nice capital and balance sheets. So there are a lot of expectations. Of course, we have seen moves, so this is nothing new that what I'm saying, but because you have been active in this sphere, I would like to get your personal experience on how do you view these players evolving their strategies.
Sure. I mean, I think this is where we get really excited by the prospect of the utility role in the e-mobility transition. And as mentioned at the start, we work a lot with utilities on large-scale transformation programs, and e-mobility is increasingly becoming another facet to that, or indeed, you know, a facet in itself. And that is because e-mobility really does evolve the traditional role of the utility. So, you know, from their position that they are now in the sort of traditional model, they will need to become installers, providers, and consultants for consumers. And they have a lot of competitive advantages here from their traditional business model. You know, so they have the experience with the wires and the infrastructure. They have that customer base. And we're already seeing some interesting things where, you know, utilities are forming partnerships with e-mobility service providers to build and operate chargers, such as with the Danish e-mobility service provider Clever and the German utility group E.ON. So I think that's just a, you know, an indication of all that we can see going forward from utilities. But of course, they also have some challenges. So they traditionally, whilst having this large customer book, don't always have the strongest record at customer management. And I think that's something that will also need to be sort of fleshed through, given that the customer use case is so central to the EV transition. But again, there's an opportunity. I think, you know, comparing utilities to oil and gas companies who are traditionally more well-versed in playing in multiple countries with a large risk appetite, you know, how can utilities work with such companies to also be part of the future? And I think that's what we're seeing a lot more of now.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch, and it will remain really interesting to watch what kind of strategies utilities, but also oil and gas companies as energy firms will adopt, because they both want the same thing. They want to play in this market to their strengths. The oil and gas companies obviously coming from having fuel stations, having forecourts, currently owning mobility customers, and having a lot of experience with pushing innovation and technology to markets internationally. Utilities, as Mira said, coming from the angle of being electricity providers, having the wires, having generation capacity, having usually business models already in place where they either sell charging solutions, produce hardware or software. But to be honest, a lot of utilities are still trying to figure out what their business model really is and how they integrate mobility with the other, you could say, commodity and non-commodity offerings they have. And that's where, you know, we see them sometimes struggling. There are some that are faster, there are some that are a little bit slower, but it will be an interesting play to watch how the landscape and the ecosystem of different energy players will transform alongside, obviously, tech companies, automotive companies, startups. So it's an excellent example for why this is a field for converging industries, where industries that haven't competed with each other are suddenly in competition, but also seeing opportunities to partner up together and collaborate.
And I think also just from an additional angle, purely for utilities, is the opportunity that vehicle to grid can provide from a value perspective. So I think this will really benefit utilities from a demand side, and to limit any additional infrastructure requirements to meet these capacity peaks. So again, an issue of tomorrow, but also something that is being heavily focused on.
Yeah, I'm just staying on this topic then. I think it's a really interesting one. We've got those two kind of profiles of companies, utilities on the one hand and the oil and gas majors, as you say, on the other. And you've got, I'm just keen to hear your opinion on how much you think they will change, how much they need to change. I mean, Till, you mentioned prosumers, and that's obviously something, and actually mirroring your response there, just, you know, vehicle to grid is obviously part of that. You know, I'm interested to see from their perspective, firstly, you know, how much will that market or developing market of prosumers allow utilities, you know, not to have to make the investments that potentially would otherwise be needed to incorporate so much electrification? And then on the other hand, you've got the oil and gas majors with all these forecourts, as you say, you know, and an awful lot of real estate. But it's not clear to me that that will necessarily be, you know, real estate in the right place for a charging yes. world. So,
yes.
you know, how do you see that evolving too?
So maybe come to the oil and gas and the location question first, because that's interesting. I agree. I mean, for various reasons, forecourts don't necessarily sit where people might charge their cars in the future, right? We see trends that the majority of charging might happen, and for Europe, it's up to 80%, both at home, so at your starting point of your journey, and at your destination, be that a workplace, be that a shopping center, a cinema, and that you definitely will need en route charging opportunities or motorways and so on. But it's not necessarily the exclusive model anymore. And for oil and gas companies, the threat is twofold. They are not only in the wrong location, they're also obviously losing various business streams. If you want, every EV customer has less incentive or no incentive in some cases to come to a forecourt and then visit maybe a retail store and do their shopping or buy their convenience products, which is significant for those firms. So yes, they have to adapt their model. They have to think about partnerships. We see solutions such as mobility hubs emerging. BP does something, for example, under their Aral brand in Germany, where increasingly you look at new multi revenue stream models, combining charging revenue with revenue as on a forecourt from retail, but also data-driven services, maybe park and ride solutions, all kind of franchise models to the Starbucks that is included on the site, making it attractive for taxi drivers or Uber drivers and all of those things. But those are business models which are new, which are untested, which require a shift away from existing assets. And that is a challenge for oil and gas companies. For utility companies, I am not sure if utility companies have figured out really how to deal with the emergence of prosumers. I wouldn't say necessary. It's an opportunity for them to save investment into assets because that sits with the consumer. I think it could also be a threat for supply companies to lose the connection to their customers. And if they don't offer essentially the right services next to providing electricity and gas, how can they stay relevant for prosumers or for future households? And I think this shift away from being just a utility and being more of than a utility to be an energy or mobility service provider is a headache for many utilities. One qualification, obviously, we speak about utilities. Utilities are not utilities, right? You have integrated utilities who have generation assets, who have grid assets, trading businesses and supply businesses, and you have pure suppliers or pure generators. And obviously, the challenges and opportunities we mentioned might apply to some of them. But not all of them.
I find this topic actually extremely important because I never thought of the difference between having access to a customer base and actually being good at customer management. And it's actually a very spot on, and I find it very honest. With vehicle to grid, we will need way more on this. We have a few technical challenges. We have, you know, cost challenges, regulatory interventions to incentivize this effort from the customer. But also, especially if there are nice synergies with household providers, it would be excellent because me as a consumer, I have one less thing to worry about. So I was just wondering, taking the example of the smart meters in the UK, is it a good sign or a bad sign? Does it mean that we need to work much harder, or does it actually mean that we can take this example as the thing to avoid and prove ourselves for this prosumer aspect with respect to e-mobility, especially?
So I think having smart meters and smarter grids and networks is a precondition for all of those business models. So I think that's a good thing. Let's not talk about whether the rollout of smart meters is successful or whether the regulation is good, because it is an entire...
I'm still waiting for mine.
See, so I think I have a view, but lots of people have. So I think it's a necessary precondition. It will be interesting now to figure out what people do with it. Because at the end of the day, I think you're right. It's about consumers will change behaviors when it comes to mobility, but there are probably also set trends in terms of simplicity, ease of use. And while electricity and gas in its purest form is probably a very boring commodity to deal with, and that model in terms of providing fitting customer service to that is not necessarily the model that is sufficient to deal with managing your increasing amount of, you know, solutions and applications you have around being a prosumer, your storage at home, your PV panels. Maybe you want to track, you want to actively see what you can do with that energy, maybe even become a micro trader just for fun. So the gamification elements of that, but also making the mobility and usage journey jointless. And why does it have to stop at the household, right? Mobility doesn't stop at the household. The electricity and the gas comes to your meter and it's a household kind of thing. Mobility kind of takes those elements a step further. And maybe you want to use your utility account to charge your car also when you're visiting your family or when you're going to work, and you want to have one bill instead of, you know, various. So I think there are all kinds of questions and opportunities. I'm not sure that utilities are necessarily the quickest one to come up with this innovation. And that's partly due to their business models. There have been utilities designed to deliver this gas and electricity commodities. That's what they do. They're there to give you a bill that is accurate. And the shift to do more is fairly recent. And I think, therefore, it's understandably that a lot of them still figure out how best to do it. And they have competition they didn't have before, right? Tech companies, charging companies, and so on.
Mm. But I think what is nice is that the all this advent of technology, even from a utility perspective, is just supporting the behavioral change that also needs to happen on the consumer side, you know, to become more engaged with their commodities, their, you know, things you take for granted, like your vehicles and your transport. I think that's all part of the journey. Utilities have dabbled in the connected homes world as well, you know, really giving that one-shop-fits-all solution to your energy usage. And I think these are all examples of what will ultimately form this broader transition that we are yet to see.
Absolutely. And where utilities have a unique advantage is they own the data, or the connection to the meter in many, many regulatory regimes. So they have that direct link into the customers, and they should use this opportunity to understand how consumer behaviors are changing, what is important for consumers, where consumers are willing to spend money for those services. And that will probably be a trend in defining and analyzing business models for utilities and suppliers specifically. And that will define who will be best placed to win.
Okay, just zooming out a little bit now, then, and I feel I have to ask this question because of just the amount of attention this area has got over the last couple of years. But obviously, we've spoken mainly around the electrification angle of things up until now. But what's your views on hydrogen? I mean, this is something that you obviously hear, you know, working in and around the energy industry, hear something about every day, multiple times a day, and also we've spoken about the oil and gas companies. So, you know, lots of people regard this as a natural fit for them because, you know, not only can they make hydrogen with carbon capture and storage, perhaps, from their products, it also could fit their refueling model that they have at the moment in terms of forecourts and things like that, as we've mentioned. And obviously also some people say, you know, for larger vehicles, you know, hydrogen is the go-to rather than batteries. What's your general thoughts in this area?
It is a really good question. And if I think back to how conversations we have around energy with all of our clients, utilities, investors, energy firms, and so on, changed over the last year, is that I think since summer last year, there wasn't a single conversation where hydrogen didn't feature. So I think it has now reached the point where it is either on the strategic agenda for all companies involved in energy, or companies have already made a decision on whether to invest in hydrogen or not. It is an interesting field. And I believe, that is an area we invest a lot of our own research and modeling activities in, that there is a merit order in terms of commercial viability for hydrogen. If you look at classic personal transport, your vehicles in your garage, I don't believe that hydrogen will ever feature a major role. If you look at long haul heavy goods transfer, absolutely. It will potentially replace diesel as a fuel that is greener, that can be produced. But by and large, I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about the cost of hydrogen, the cost of production, the cost of transportation, the cost of storage, the localization of business cases. So we see a lot of niche applications for hydrogen, airports where buses have to run ideally around the clock and where you simply can't afford to put it on a charger. Warehouses where you have vehicles that equally need to run 24/7 in global delivery and supply economies. So I think those niche applications are there, but the wider rollout for hydrogen will probably be more focused on heavy goods transport, especially in long haul and heavy industry applications. So essentially where you can't really electrify things, that's where you will see hydrogen. You asked about hydrogen and oil and gas companies. Yes, obviously. But at the same point, utilities that increasingly have to move away from thermal generation and invest in renewable generation, be it offshore wind, onshore wind, or depending where you are, for example, in Florida, solar, see hydrogen as a new kind of route to market, essentially. Because it, depending on business cases and demand sectors, I think it's not only oil and gas companies looking at this. It is spread amongst classic generators, tech firms, investors are looking into space. Network companies, especially gas businesses, try to figure out, could hydrogen be a replacement for heating, right? What to do with the pipelines that run through the UK, both the transmission network and the distribution network. So I think it's a universal kind of interest in hydrogen and transport, and it being a fuel replacement is just one area of interest.
What other trends do you expect to see in the clean transport sphere overall? What do you expect on the one hand, and what you would like to see? So some complaints there and some wishes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very broad question, so maybe just focusing on a few pertinent points. I think what we expect to see is definitely a commercial trend, and I think we've not touched on this before in this round, but I think we will see an increased wave of acquisitions, consolidations, buying into innovation. And I think this is because of the various players that have a stake in the ground and also have a natural sort of fit, I guess, to the transition, will just require different mechanisms, different business models to ensure that they're getting bought in. And I think this will drive standardization, which is great. I think other trends that we can also expect and that we've touched on before is more of that carbon-focused regulation. So, of course, we have the ICE ban in 2030. European countries are lobbying for the same for an EU-wide ban. And I think this will just be something that will become the norm, as part of the other targets. Another trend which I hope we do see more of is this increased customer centricity and really recognizing the different use cases to even simple things like, you know, temperature changes. If you are in a European city driving up the snowy mountains, that's going to have an impact on your car. It's going to have an impact on how, whereabouts you can find your charging points. And I think these nuances is something that also needs to be fed through and hopefully is a trend that we see more of. And then finally, I guess, an increase in energy management optimization that utilizes EVs. So we've spoken about vehicle to grid. I think this will become pertinent, but also smart energy management. You know, what is that right balance between within the grid among the regular demand for power?
Maybe to build on the point on expected M&A, I think with that goes an increasing interest of the investor community in mobility. A couple of years back, we had a lot of conversations with infrastructure investors, PEs, you know, venture capital firms were already a little bit more active at the point. But a lot of those classic investors shied away from investing, for example, in charging infrastructure because they couldn't figure out the business models. They didn't necessarily trust the technology. How quickly would chargers need to be replaced? How does it disrupt existing kind of regulated and non-regulated asset bases? And we are now seeing a lot of investment models from leasing models to project financing emerging where investors work with cities to finance the electrification of public transport fleets, taking risk away from those cities. So it is almost like a new dawn and new business models go with, you know, new investment funds, for example, being set up focused on those areas. And that's interesting to watch as well.
So wrapping up the episode, what are some exciting plans that you have at CRRA? Is there anything you can talk to us about, something exciting to wait for?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having us. It was a really exciting talk, and I hope we could bring across our enthusiasm for this sector and what it does to the energy industry, but also to other industries. We are in almost all of our projects for energy firms are coming across the question on how mobility-related business models need to be integrated. However, we see also that As energy experts, there's only so much we can do. We can talk about the wires, we can talk about grids, we can talk about regulation, generation, consumer models, but our expertise stops somewhere. And this is why we are really, really excited about our collaboration with HubCheck Consulting to address an even wider client base and audience to have more meaningful conversations about what is increasingly becoming a cross-industry ecosystem. And I think it's only right for us as service providers to also look at collaborations and partnerships in order to in order to have those interesting discussions. So we are very excited about what comes next.
There's a lot of discussion that can be had on this topic. From our perspective, at least, we are really building on the momentum from this webinar that we recently held with the key industry players. So if listeners do have further questions, then just do get in touch with us.
Thanks very much to Till and Mira there. I really enjoyed the chat we had. It was really great to hear their perspective on this. And that's about it from us today. Please feel free to check out all of the episodes on the podcast section of the Inspiration website, but also on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps pretty much that you can find out there. And give us a like or subscribe. Also, get in touch by emailing podcasts@inspiration.com for any comments and suggestions of what we should be doing in future episodes. And all that's left for me now is to say thank you to my co-host, Meritina.
Thank you, John.
And this is me signing off for the last time. Thank you to all our guests and listeners and everyone who has supported the podcast along the way. Much thanks from me and bon voyage and goodbye.
Your watch has ended. Bye, John.